This podcast is about correcting the balance, whether it's something celebrated as good when it shouldn't be, or the other way around. Or maybe the heroic tales of history just need to be knocked straight on their ass. Me? I just want to share the complete picture, because that's when this whole thing gets fun. Warning, jokes and sarcasm may ensue. Welcome to Prick the Balloon. Hi, I'm Mike Vance, and welcome to Prick the Balloon, episode 15. I'm a sports guy, but I totally realize that millions of people are not. So if your gut reaction was, ew, sports, stupid sweaty jocks, I'm asking you to bear with me for about 30 seconds. This episode is about integrating sports. And the fact is that those events hugely impacted American society in a myriad of non-sports ways. Lots of times, sports was a forerunner, one way or another, to what the government was going to do on race. From something that may feel like a sports story, you get a great perspective on civil rights and major changes in working rights. So really, this is going to be the usual fun and snarky American history. You may not even get sweaty. Though you probably want to wear a jock, a cup, and a helmet. I mean, I am. The multi-million dollar salaries notwithstanding, sports have always been a bit of a microcosm of society as a whole. You get some fantastic snidely whiplash villains and people who put up with flaming saucepans of shit. Like I said, sports led the way on moving us toward integration. So, stop the idiotic comments about sports ball for a little bit. It makes you look bad anyway. You don't see me trying to deny joy to people who like ballet, do you? I'm not going to make fun of your Margot Fonteyn rookie card or your game-used Nijinsky rosin bag. So dance on, amigos. Plie to your heart's content. Now, let's get ready to history. When people think about integrating sports, most people focus on Jackie Robinson. That's the famous story, as well it should be. Major League Baseball still celebrates Jackie Robinson Day every April 15th. But the whole saying about Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier really should be re-breaking the color barrier, because baseball was just like everything else in America. There was a brief decade or two in history, namely the 1870s and 80s, where there were signs of actual progress in civil rights. But like everything else in history in every country, there is always the little brother who eats a bushel of jelly beans, duct tapes the cat, breaks your mom's favorite coffee mug, and that is why we can't have nice things. If you haven't ever read anything about Oberlin College in Ohio, it is a pretty cool spot historically. It's outside of Cleveland, which is a hugely underrated city. And let me just stop you right there. The water also caught fire in San Francisco, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Buffalo, Houston, and Galveston. That's where the saying, from sea to shining sea, actually comes from. So get off poor Cleveland's back, will ya? Anyway, Oberlin College became integrated in 1835. They claimed to be the first college in the U.S. to regularly admit black students as a matter of course. Maybe. I had a neighbor once who claimed that he scored with one of the Shirelles, so who knows? I can tell you that Middlebury College in Vermont and Bowdoin College in Maine had black graduates in the 1820s. I'll also point out that none of those places had a very large black population at the time at all. So how much real credit did they deserve if it only came up once every other decade? People love to blame the South for all racism in America, but not only is that the rankest of cow patty talk, you have to realize that in 1900, 90% of African Americans lived in the South. 90%. So that makes some of these famous firsts for the rest of the country, well, it makes it kind of an anomaly. In short, every state has plenty of guilt to go around. Anyway, Oberlin, on the other hand, was a known stop on the Underground Railroad, which was much more difficult to ride than, let's say, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood trolley. But that's got another episode written all over it, so let's move on. The Oberlin College guy I want to mention is Moses Fleetwood Walker. He was part of Oberlin College's first baseball team in 1881. In fact, he was one of two persons of color on the team, but he was their best player. After 1 year, he was good enough that he transferred to the University of Michigan, but things did not go all that smooth. He wasn't allowed to eat in the dining hall, and at both places, Walker's team ran into opponents who refused to take the field against a team with a black player. Still, Moses Fleetwood Walker and his brother went on to play professionally with the Toledo Blue Stockings in the 1880s, when Toledo was considered a major league team, and he was the last black major leaguer in 1884. When the very first official National Amateur Baseball Association was formed in 1867, the teams agreed to make it whites only by rule. A few years later, when the professional organization formed, there was a vague expectation that things would remain all white, but nobody really wrote it down. So you got black baseball players at various levels. Bud Fowler is a fascinating guy who played on integrated pro teams in the 1870s. There was a black player for the Providence Grays in 1879, and that was a top National League club. Teams continued to drop in an occasional black player and play occasional black teams. That is until 1884, when Moses Fleetwood Walker and his brother Weldy Walker lost their jobs with Toledo. At least one minor league, the International League, kept allowing black players for a few more seasons. The guy that gets the blame for drawing the hard and fast color line is Cap Anson. Anson was from Marshalltown, Iowa, which I am sure is just as exciting in real life as it sounds on paper. Google things to do in Marshalltown, and number three is to nail Luke's sister in the big treehouse. Apparently, she'll put out for Skittles. Cap Anson was a star player and manager in the early National League, maybe the first true star player, in fact. He was physically bigger than most other players, he played dirty, he was a mean son of a bitch, and he was a bullying racist. It was him who refused to let his team from Chicago play an exhibition against Toledo and Moses Walker. But Anson backed down under pressure to salvage the gate receipts. Just like politics, it's all about the money. 5 years later, the same thing happened again in Newark, but this time the Newark pitcher and catcher were both black. This time, Anson got his way, and the game was canceled. Now, he wasn't the only one crying for a ban on black players, but he was the most prominent. Does he really deserve the horrible reputation he has today for being a total piece of shit as a human? You bet your ass he does. He was the loudest voice, and face it, nobody remembers the Jeffrey Epstein clients who were just somebody's CPA neighbor named Gary. Segregated black baseball teams predate the Civil War. That's how it was handled. You form your own team. Full black baseball leagues go back to the 1860s. They were all over the country. Both the black and white leagues at those lower levels came and went, but they were there. And baseball fans of one race always went to see teams of the other race. Advertising targeted fans of the opposite race. In many cases, there were separate sections of the grandstands for white and black spectators. No mixing, y'all, but we want your money! Even in the South, even after the teams integrated, the bleachers stayed segregated for a few more years. One of the most frustrating situations in all this baseball racism is what faced Latinos. You were in or out of the big leagues based on how dark you were. Baseball in Cuba had been huge since well back into the 19th century. People like to put that down to the Spanish-American War, but it was earlier, and by the start of the 1900s, there were some Cuban players good enough to play in the show. Thing was, though, that like Americans, Cubans range from light to dark, and baseball had no trouble at all taking Cuban players as long as they were light-skinned. The Cuban leagues themselves were integrated, and U.S. big league teams, U.S. big league white teams, would go to Cuba and play either black or integrated teams pretty regularly. So there were more levels of hypocrisy in all this than Jimmy Swaggart at a Holiday Inn. Bit of trivia. The first Latino ball player in MLB was Colombian, not Cuban, a guy named Lou Castro, who played in 42 games with the Philadelphia A's. But the name to know in all this is Dolph Luque. Luque was a pitcher for the Cincinnati Reds and three other National League teams starting in 1914. Luque was a star Cuban player in the white big leagues, and he played for 20 years. Meanwhile, at the same time in Cuba, there's this superstar pitcher named José Méndez, whose nickname is El Diamante Negro, the Black Diamond. He beat several white big league teams in exhibitions, but he wasn't allowed to play in the league against them because he was way too dark to meet that vague eye test. Not all of the field personnel were happy about this ban on black players. New York Giants manager John McGraw tried to pass off Charlie Grant as some kind of Indian in 1901. It didn't fly, but at least three other known cases exist of black guys passing as Indians in minor leagues. Sometimes you can pull it off. I once passed as a Canadian to keep from getting beat up at a pub in Edinburgh, so I say go for it, eh? There were also interracial games that dated back into the 1860s. Some were just straight-up regular competition. Some served a purpose. I wrote about one in the big early Houston baseball book I did, where the Galveston, Texas White Texas League team played the top local black team as a fundraiser for a white player who needed help with a family crisis. So that sure looks like there was respect between the players, and a very mixed racist expectation among owners and fans. Those things continued as isolated games for decades, but by World War II, with the military still segregated, I've run across all kinds of mentions of white military teams playing black military teams here in the States and in Europe and the Pacific. In between, there were barnstorming tours where teams cobbled together a few of the all-star players on each side of the color line who would play their counterparts. The most famous of the black teams were led by Satchel Paige and other Negro League players, and then they'd go out on the road in the offseason and play against white teams led by the likes of Dizzy Dean and Bob Feller, plus other white big leaguers. Damn it, I would have loved to have seen some of those games. The stories are that those fellas, all-time greats, had some real fun and played some real games. Bill Veeck, who later became the only general manager to break the color line with two different teams, saw one of those Paige versus Dean games and he called it, quote, the greatest pitching matchup he ever saw, end quote. Shit, I would even buy an $18 beer or two and eat squirt cheese nachos with month-old chips. Horse racing gets forgotten as a sport, but it was the biggest sport in America in the 1700s and 1800s. People loved betting, and they loved betting on their horses. And many, if not most, of the expert grooms who took care of those horses and the jockeys who rode those horses were enslaved blacks. Yep, being a slave did not necessarily mean you picked cotton. It was the most prevalent job, but people in slavery did everything, and tons of them were skilled craftsmen at things like carpentry or dressmaking, and that sure as shit included taking care of the horses, all the way down to making the shoes and the harness and tending to the veterinary care. After emancipation, the best jockeys, well, they're still black, so they kept doing what they did. In 1875, the first Kentucky Derby was run. There were 15 horses entered, and 13 of them had black jockeys. The winner was ridden by a black man named Oliver Lewis. In the last decade of the 1800s, black jockeys won 6 Derbies, 1 Preakness, and 3 Belmont Stakes. That's the horse racing Triple Crown in the 1890s. Then the whole thing just disappeared like a sawbuck at a 3-card Monte table. The last black jockey to win a Triple Crown race was a fellow named Jimmy Winkfield in 1902, albeit a very tiny little miniature fellow. Tiny. The reason that changed was because the white jockeys started conspiring to box out the black jockeys on the track and bumping them to make sure they didn't win. And the owners are like, Jesus, don't hurt the horse! Because they could give two shits about the jockeys, but the horses were worth a lot of money. So the black jockeys just quit getting offered rides. Just like that. Poof. The lesser talented white jockeys forced the black jockeys out of work. Boxing was the most integrated sport in America. There were interracial prize fights all the damn time. The exception were fights for the heavyweight championship. When that came up for real with Jack Johnson just after the start of the 20th century, the white champion, Jim Jeffries, ducked him every which way, and then finally retired without ever facing Johnson. Jack Johnson, who had this big gold grill, by the way, finally got his shot in 1908 and became world heavyweight champ. Back then, before TV, movie companies filmed the fights, and they shipped prints of these movies around the world so people could go to theaters and buy tickets to watch. When Johnson won the big fights, white authorities tried to stop the prints of a black man beating a white man from being shown. Finally, Congress made the entire fight film business illegal. It works so well with porn, I'm sure nobody ever saw them. Oh, wait, that's right, they're on YouTube. Throughout the whole time Johnson was champ, which lasted 5 years, Jack London, the guy who wrote White Fang and was a big newspaper man, kept calling for a, quote, great white hope, end quote, to restore the title to white hands. that eventually lured Jim Jeffries out of retirement so he could also get his ass kicked by Jack Johnson. Since they couldn't beat him in the ring, the man had Johnson arrested, basically on grounds that he had a major thing for white women. His big 1908 victory parade in his hometown of Galveston got canceled when people found out Jack was traveling with a white woman. Ultimately, one of these women turned on him and helped get him convicted of crossing state lines for immoral purposes. Ha! Oops! Everyone who's just been to Vegas just got a little butt pucker, didn't they? Well, Johnson was sentenced to a year and a day in the pokey. But for at least the second time in his life, the prison warden staged exhibition fights while he was inside. Little jailhouse side hustle never hurt anyone. Say it with me, Zihuatanejo. The next big black heavyweight champ was Joe Louis in the 1930s, at about the same time Jesse Owens became a national hero on the track. Both Louis and Owens had these huge victories over the Nazis and got all kinds of love for defending freedom and America's honor, even if they didn't have the freedom to eat and sleep any place they wanted. Then you got other black boxing stars following them. So, some sports seem to be just fine with mixing races. Don't get me wrong, these guys still heard all the name-calling, including from other fighters, and sometimes the white boxers got paid more, even when they were ranked lower. But it was definitely better than it was with the team sports. Football and basketball are huge sports now, obviously, but they took a backseat to baseball and boxing and horse racing for many, many decades. But both of them have a surprising integration story. In the early days of the NFL, as in right at the start, there were two black players, Fritz Pollard and Bobby Marshall. Fritz Pollard is now in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He had gone to school at Brown, led Brown to the Rose Bowl in 1915, then he fought in World War I, came back, and became a pro football player. He was the star for the Akron Pros. Okay, not exactly the most creative nickname in sports history, but it separates him from the Akron Hobbyists. Pollard led the Pros to an undefeated season in 1920 and won the first ever NFL championship. The year after that, the Pros made Fritz Pollard co-head coach, so he was also the first black coach in NFL history. But the man forced him out. He played on some lesser teams, and then he formed an all-black football team in Chicago that barnstormed around playing against white teams. He spent the last half of his life running a talent agency and in music production. Pollard later said, quote, "It was evident in my first year in Akron back in 1919 that they didn't want blacks in there getting that money. And here I was, playing and coaching and pulling down the highest salary in pro football," end quote. Football, at the beginning, was a college sport, and several colleges had black players right from the start. Not a ton, but there were African Americans playing football at places like Michigan and Harvard in the late 1800s. Pro football took a backseat to college, but it was still a way guys could get paid for playing sports, and what could be better than that? From the time of the first little rinky-dink pro league, about the start of the 1900s, there were a few black players. Fritz Pollard was pretty lonely as a face of color when the NFL started, but from 1919 to 1933, there were always at least two, and never more than four, black players in the league. Baseball was hardcore segregated, but football was not. And then it just stopped. The U.S. was in a dark, stinky bottom of the Great Depression, the economic bilge, and somehow white team owners decided that they didn't want to be paying black men to play football. Remember a few episodes ago I was talking about Foghorn Bilbo, the senator from Mississippi who blamed the Depression on blacks? Well, he wasn't alone, and it was enough public opinion to cause this collusion among the white NFL owners. So though football had been lightly integrated for some 60 years, in 1934, it suddenly became whiter than a French battle flag. And that's a joke because the French have a brave history. Just not in the last 100 years. Anyway, it was 13 years before the NFL reintegrated. That came in 1946, which was also the same year that Jackie Robinson returned blacks to professional baseball when he played his year of minor league ball for the Montreal Royals. Just like after World War I, after World War II, all of these black soldiers felt like they had earned some rights after laying their lives on the line. They were very public about it with the Double Victory campaign. It's like, you're going to send me out to get shot on your behalf, but you won't let me use your toilet. And while the government didn't agree with them, and most American citizens were still having a hard time with the idea, the two biggest pro sports in the country stepped up and broke down the color barrier, even if it was a little bit at a time. In 1946, four black players came into pro football: Kenny Washington, Bill Willis, Marion Motley, and Woody Strode. Washington and Strode had played college football at UCLA with Jackie Robinson, and Woody Strode, who was one of the coolest dudes ever, I might add, also became a movie star, playing one of the main gladiators in Spartacus and John Wayne's hired hand Pompey in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Print the legend. That's some big stuff right there. Basketball is a relatively new sport. The origin story is James Naismith using peach baskets in 1891. Little known fact, there's an earlier story about Cajuns involving crawfish baskets, but it made the ball smell horrible, and the Cajuns got drunk, and then they forgot the rules. The NBA didn't even start until 1946, the same year that basketball and football reintegrated, but it was all white at the start. A year later, the NBA had their first Asian player, a dude named Wat Mesaka. What? But they didn't allow black players in the NBA until 1950, when three guys, Earl Big Cat Lloyd, Chuck Cooper, and Nat Sweetwater Clifton, got drafted. Earl Lloyd was the first to play in a game for the Washington Capitals, but before that, he had been a star with the Harlem Globetrotters. He was also the first guy to use a bucket of confetti play in the NBA Finals. One of the most famous race and basketball stories is, of course, UT El Paso winning the NCAA title over an all-white Kentucky team in 1966. That's the movie Glory Road, though Coach Don Haskins somehow lost 150 pounds on the big screen. Weird. Just like football, there had been lots of integrated college basketball teams, but not for very long. UCLA had the first black basketball star, Don Barksdale, who became the first African-American winner of an Olympic basketball medal, a gold in 1948. All of the big conferences had what they called gentlemen's agreements to keep things white. And that does not sound very gentlemanly at all to me. Those are really more like spiteful, cowardly, tiny hands agreements to me. Really tiny hands. Indiana University broke the agreement in the Big Ten in 1947, but the real credit for integrating college basketball should go to John Wooden. Sure, he became famous as the coach of the UCLA Bruins that won approximately 827 national titles in a row, but Wooden started out at Indiana State, the Sycamores. His team won the Indiana Collegiate title in 1948, but Wooden refused to go to the postseason tournament because they didn't allow black players. He said, nope. Not going. They won again the following year, and this time the college bigwigs changed their policy to accommodate Wooden's team. But that was not the end of it. After college basketball made strides, there was another gentleman's agreement
assholes
to not play more than three black players at a time. Loyola of Chicago, the school with the cheerleading nuns, broke that unwritten rule in 1962. The following year, in 1963, Loyola played University of Cincinnati in the NCAA championship. Loyola won the title with four black starters. Cincinnati started three blacks. So seven of the 10 starting players in the college finals in 1963. And that was considered groundbreaking for basketball. Hockey, you say? Well, the NHL hopes to integrate sometime in the 2030s. Ha! Just kidding. The first black NHL player was a guy named Willie O'Ree in 1958. Yep, O apostrophe re, as in leprechaun. But come on, it's hockey. Swedes and Canadians, for crying out loud. In all seriousness, it is still 97% white to this day. Maybe it's just that black American men are getting enough of dudes swinging sticks at them just dealing with the cops. Just a theory. Golf had several famous battles over integration because it is played at country clubs that had all white as part of their bylaws. Unless you were serving the scotch and soda or schlepping the bag around 18 holes, you were white. The pioneer here is Charlie Sifford. The thing is, with golf, you're kind of on your own. You have to get invited to try out for the PGA Tour and then win one of the slots. Charlie Sifford got his first shot at qualifying for a pro golf event in 1952 at the Phoenix Open when Joe Louis, the former heavyweight champ, managed to score him an invitation. Sifford got every bit of the racial abuse and death threats that you would expect, but he kept trying. He won the Long Beach Open in 1957, even though that was only half a PGA event. He qualified for the U.S. Open in 1959, which is officially a big-ass deal, and finished in 32nd place. But Charlie Sifford did not become a PGA Tour golfer until 1961, which made the PGA remove a Caucasians-only clause from their bylaws. The U.S. Open, by the way, is just that. It is open to anyone who is good enough to qualify. It is real sports democracy. The first black player, half black and half Shinnecock Indian, actually, was John Shippen, and he played in 1896 at the course called Shinnecock Hills. Other players threatened to boycott, but the U.S. Golf Association held their ground. And I just am hoping that Shippen pulled out the Shinnecock Indian card and told those whiny whiteys at Shinnecock Hills, "Hey, thanks for coming to my course." Lee Trevino, one of my all-time favorite golfers, called Charlie Sifford the Jackie Robinson of golf. Trevino, by the way, was far from the first Hispanic pro golfer. That would go to Al Espinoza way back in the 1920s. Espinoza was really good, and he went to a playoff to try to win the U.S. Open in 1928. He missed it by that much. So how important was Charlie Sifford in golf? Tiger Woods named his son after him. Still, there were certain country clubs who wouldn't let Charlie in the locker room. Augusta National Golf Course, home of the Masters, an event like no other, had its first black player, Lee Elder, in 1975. But they didn't allow a black member at the club until 1990. Charlie Sifford never got to play the Masters. And let me just say, the name came from the phrase Masters of Golf, which was something dreamt up when the tournament was founded. The name had nothing to do with slavery. However, the clubhouse at Augusta National was indeed a plantation home, built by enslaved labor in 1854. And get this, the club rules demanded all caddies be black until 1983. And if that doesn't have white supremacy literally scrawled all over it, then my dogs don't sniff butts. And trust me, they are butt-sniffing fools. Little trivia. The modern wooden golf tee was invented by a black dentist in 1899. The same guy also invented Wednesdays off for medical practitioners. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for your headliner, Jackie Robinson.
Yay!
Branch Rickey, the GM of the Brooklyn Dodgers, famously signed Jackie Robinson right after the end of World War II. The real color barrier part took place with a season in the minor leagues playing at Montreal. Jackie had the only dark skin in that league, too. It's not the majors, and it's not the U.S., but there were incidents just like there would be a year later with Brooklyn. But Robinson's team won their league and the AAA postseason series, too. The next year, he was brought up to start the season in the majors. It was the biggest news story of 1947 in the United States. That was also the year of independence for India and Pakistan and the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act that gutted American labor to this day. Plus, the microwave was invented in 1947 and changed the entire trajectory of popcorn. But Jackie made more headlines. You know, that microwave thing also spelled the end of Jiffy Pop on the stove and created this glut of American tinfoil, which has since been filled by making Aaron Rodgers hats. You've seen the movies. There's no need to go over every detail of the Jackie Robinson story. 42 was really well done. Jackie had trouble with his own teammates. Handful of them got traded away after they complained too loudly. Another handful of teammates got to know Jackie as a person and totally came around. The famous incidents involve Ben Chapman, the manager of the Phillies, who was brutal in attacking Jackie Robinson and got his whole team to take part in dirty play and constant strings of abuse in every single game. But it wasn't just the Phillies. The St. Louis Cardinals came to Brooklyn 3 weeks into the season and threatened not to play the game if Jackie Robinson took the field. Guess what? The racists lost. And when they did start the games, two of those players for St. Louis went above and beyond in trying to physically injure Jackie Robinson. Those two guys didn't have just one single case of trying to inflict a serious injury with their shoe spikes. They kept doing it repeatedly all year. A guy named Enos Slaughter and Joe Garagiola. Now, you remember him, a grinning, bald-headed, yuck-fest bag-of-nothing who was a baseball broadcaster and game show host. He got credit in 1960 for a baseball humor book that was entirely ghostwritten by another guy, and that somehow launched his career as some funny man. You saying he's funny? Does he amuse you like some sort of clown? Garagiola was a guest all the time on the Match Game, but I bet if you dug into it, you'll find that Joe tried to spike Nipsey Russell. Let's look at America in 1947, when Jackie Robinson made his major league debut. There had been 7 well-publicized lynchings in the 1940s. 10 states still had a poll tax designed to keep poor blacks from voting. In 4 of those states, it was cumulative. It kept adding up until you paid it. There had been race riots a few years earlier in New York City, Detroit, and Beaumont, Texas. Sundown laws were all over the damn country. Black travelers still had to use the Green Book when they left town, and without the benefit of Viggo Mortensen or any hokey-pokey at the Y, I might add, if you get my drift.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, man of the world.
The U.S. military was still segregated in 1947, even though 2.5 million black Americans had just fought in World War II. President Truman didn't end that until July 1948, and Jackie Robinson softened the blowback a little. Baseball was by far the most popular sport in America, so Jackie's appearance in baseball was off the charts huge. Yeah, Jackie did largely as Branch Rickey told him to do, took most of the abuse, answered with great play on the field, but that is not the end of the story. That's one guy, and just like those lone black graduates at Middlebury and Bowdoin in the 1820s, one guy does not mean we have reached some kind of critical mass of racial equality. Just ask the woman who's been laid once in 35 years, how are you feeling about your sex life? Just like one Freedom Rider bus doesn't mean all discrimination ended, there is a lot more to this baseball integration story. For starters, the Dodgers are just one team among what was then 16. So which organizations were good and which ones were bad? The Cleveland Indians and the St. Louis Browns were the next two teams to bring up black players. They both did it in July 1947, so just 2.5 months after Jackie debuted with the Dodgers. Little side story here. The Indians' general manager the following year, 1948, was Hank Greenberg, one of the greatest power hitters of all time and my big money bet for the best Jewish baseball player ever. He was most valuable player in 1935, and he almost broke the single-season home run record in 1938. The story was that opposing pitchers intentionally walked Greenberg a shitload of times late in the year because they didn't want Babe Ruth's record broken by a Jew. So the guy is not a schlub. Greenberg is one of those players who fought in World War II rather than shirk duty, but there is a lot more to that too. He had been drafted before Pearl Harbor and served and got discharged on December 5th, 1941. When the U.S. went to war 2 days later, Greenberg volunteered to go back. He ended the war in China as ground personnel for airplanes bombing Japan. Hank Greenberg served 47 months in the Army, longer than any other major league ballplayer. But in 1947, he was playing a final season for the Pittsburgh Pirates, and they faced Jackie and the Dodgers. The first season they played each other, Greenberg and Robinson collided at first base. Robinson got knocked down. Greenberg was 6'4", 230, so what do you expect? Unlike those Cardinal players, Greenberg went over to Jackie and asked if he's okay. Then he tells him, quote, "Stick in there. You're doing fine. Keep your chin up," end quote. When Hank Greenberg became GM at Cleveland the next year, he signed more black players to contracts than any other GM in baseball. The Dodgers brought up 3 more black players over the next 2 years. So did the Indians. The New York Giants broke their color barrier in 1949, the Braves in 1950, White Sox 1951. On the shit side of that ledger, the last two teams to integrate were the Detroit Tigers and the Boston Red Sox. That was a dozen years after Jackie Robinson and 1947. It took the Yankees until 1955 and the Phillies until 1957. And here is a super telling story about the Philadelphia Phillies. Remember, they're the ones with the manager that had his whole team pile on abuse like they were psychotic 12-year-olds with a wounded possum and a stick. But the Phillies' GM was an overrated asswipe of an ex-Yankee pitcher named Herb Pennock. He called up Branch Rickey and threatened to boycott games against a black player. Rickey called his bluff, And a lot of the credit here goes to the commissioner of baseball at the time, Happy Chandler, who was a politician from Kentucky and who was, for the most part, an all-around good dude. He was known to bust out singing My Old Kentucky Home, whether people ask him or not. Really, which makes him like your crazy uncle who may or may not wear pantyhose. Not only did Happy Chandler greenlight integration, Happy Chandler also started the Players' Pension Program and sold the first TV broadcast and sponsorship rights to the World Series, money which went into the pension fund. Now, all of this good stuff pissed off the fat cat owners, and they didn't renew his contract. Still, the next time you hear, "The official hemorrhoid cream of Major League Baseball," think of Happy Chandler. When the Dodgers showed up at the Ben Franklin Hotel in Philly, where they had been staying for years, the hotel, possibly goaded by Pennock, refused to give Robinson a room, so the Dodgers' entire team moved to the Warwick. Here's the saddest part about that story, and the overall sense of both baseball and America in general. Herb Pennock, the dickweed Philly GM who had grown up in a local suburb, had come up for the Baseball Hall of Fame vote in 1946, and he got 16%. 2 years later, after his public opposition to integration, Herb Pennock was elected to the Hall with 82% of the vote. Those accommodation problems went on for years. It wasn't until 1954 that every city but one in the major leagues had hotels who would accept integrated teams. The exception was Baltimore, where not a single decent place took African Americans. St. Louis and Cincinnati took until 1954 before they allowed blacks in a hotel, but they refused those same men the use of the dining room or the pool. Hank Aaron said it was almost impossible for him to find a place to eat in Cincinnati. Of course, those are people that think sweet chili and cheddar cheese constitute spaghetti sauce. So, I'm kidding on that one. I've done my Skyline chili time, and I've lived to tell about it. One big byproduct of Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby, Roy Campanella, Hank Thompson, Willard Brown, Minnie Minoso, Sam Jethro, and his Uncle Jed all coming to the big leagues was that it ended the Negro Leagues. Like, really fast. Those separate black ball leagues had been around for 70 years, but once there were black players in the bigs, that is all black fans wanted to see. The teams with African American players developed instant followings, and within 3 years, the top Negro League teams were pretty much done. Which has to suck really hard if you're one of those guys making a living in the Negro Leagues who wasn't quite good enough to get a chance in the bigs. At that point, it's back to the auto factory or teaching. And there were several, by the way, of those Negro League players who were teachers and coaches in the offseason. Total rabbit trail here. I know a guy whose dad was named Pat Patterson. Pat Patterson had been an all-star infielder for the Philadelphia Stars, Kansas City Monarchs, Pittsburgh Crawfords, and Newark Eagles, all top Negro League teams. In the offseason, he would come home to Houston and coach at Yates High School. At least 1 year, he missed the last half of the Negro World Series because he couldn't afford to lose his teaching job. Well, Pat Patterson coached his Yates Lions to multiple state titles in baseball, football, basketball, and track. How about that shit for an accomplishment? Players today spend their offseason running the beaches in Fiji, diddling around their Mercedes dealerships, or if you're Trevor Bauer, trying to escape various felony charges. Spring training was another run through the thorns for black players. Everything in Florida was segregated, and the teams went along with it all the way up until the early 1960s. The Dodgers had been the first and only team to do anything about the situation. They bought a little decommissioned Navy base and turned it into a separate, self-contained spring training complex. But the other teams, it was separate places to stay and eat, even separate black taxicabs to get around. Some of the teams went so far as to segregate the clubhouse laundry by race. But several of the players, led by Bill White of the Cardinals and Bill Bruton, who had become a leader on the Braves, called the owners on the whole thing. They pointed out how much stroke the owners had in these small towns who really counted on that spring train and money. Bruton and White pressured the teams, and in 1962, seven clubs opened integrated spring training. The White Sox and Yankees built hotels. The Cardinals threatened to move out of St. Pete until a local businessman miraculously made two hotels available. Now, how tough was that? The Phillies and Tigers were the last two holdouts, and both had to be threatened with fan boycotts back home before they changed. Note that we are still 2 years away from Congress giving in to LBJ and passing the Comprehensive Civil Rights Act. But there's one more area we need to explore. That was just the experience for the big leagues. What was it like for minor leaguers? Well, it was worse. Unlike the NBA and the NFL, in baseball, you pay some serious-ass dues. You're riding smelly buses between towns where the Dairy Queen Hunger Buster is your best and only dining option. In the decade and a half after Jackie Robinson, most of those low-level ball clubs also just had one or two black players, and some of the places they played were either in the hardcore broken appliance on the porch Appalachians or the you're made and may or may not have shit in your pie deep south. And these minor league guys face the same lonely struggle too. They're just in Hooterville. That's because even after the last team had integrated, there was still this very unofficial quota system.
Sure, we got black guys, but let's not go crazy. Two is plenty, right? You don't want to see no Spike Lee movie breakout.
You had these teams where it was 3-2-1 single player facing the racist abuse every day, but they were without any major league support system. They're getting this shit thrown at them in Spartanburg and Bristol. Yeah, several of those minor leagues were in the deep-ass South, and you bet your Waffle House grits that's an official name. We're talking towns where people can't leave the house without rubbing a little smack of Cairo syrup on their nether regions. The Texas League was the first. They integrated in 1952. Now, a reminder that fully half of the major leagues were still lily white until 1954. So 2 full years before there were black players in D.C., St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and the other four I already named, there were black players in Dallas and very soon after in San Antonio and Houston. Every Texas team in the league was integrated by 1956, when we're still waiting on the Phillies, Tigers, and Red Sox. Now, let's be clear, the black Texas leaguers were still faced with segregated hotels and dining rooms. They couldn't eat and stay with their white teammates. Frank Robinson, another Hall of Famer and the first ever black major league manager, said some places he stayed were up to 4 people to a room and no shower. But there were leagues throughout the South. And I am talking the deepest hollers of squeal like a pig country. A black player was sent to Danville, Virginia in the Carolina League in 1951, and he stayed 19 games before he got moved because the fans were filing too many complaints. The real pioneer for the Carolina League was Bill White, who I just mentioned, in 1953, and he went on to become president of the National League. But that first year in Danville, White took so much verbal abuse that he asked the parent club to ship him somewhere else. But he was the leading hitter on the team, and the ownership refused. He once had to be escorted to the bus by bat-wielding teammates because he had flipped off the crowd. White's biography was titled Uppity. Also in 1953, there was a thing called the Cotton States League in Arkansas and Mississippi. That year, the team in Hot Springs attempted to sign a black player named Jim Turgeson, who may or may not have been related to George C. Scott's character in Dr. Strangelove. The other team owners threw a giant racist little girl hissy fit and eventually forced the owner of the Hot Springs club to sell his team. Turgeson filed a civil rights lawsuit against the league and lost. So just like Jackie, one guy didn't make the waters smooth. When I mentioned the Texas League a second ago, I phrased things very carefully. There was one team in the league which was in Louisiana, the Shreveport Sports, and the Louisiana legislature passed a no racial mixing law aimed at sports integration. Now, I'm not sure of all the ramifications, but it was one of hundreds of laws that followed the Brown versus the Board Supreme Court decision in 54 that were designed to save segregation by making it stronger and somehow lawsuit-proof. It's the same kind of pure D hate think still going strong in the Republican Party today. When one of those other Texas teams was scheduled to play in Shreveport, they had to leave their dark-skinned players at home, black or Latino. That included a few names of guys who later became major league stars, one Hall of Famer. The Texas League offices complained, but not about the human rights aspect. They complained about it affecting the competitive balance of the games. And I'll remind you again of the date here. Sports was doing something that the U.S. Congress wouldn't manage to pass for another 10 years. The end result of the change to the Shreveport situation was that black fans boycotted the entire league. The Shreveport team lost so much money that they were put up for sale, and the Texas League kicked them out in 1958, still 6 years before LBJ finally managed the biggest civil rights act. What happened to the Shreveport Sports? They were immediately accepted into the Southern Association, the last all-white league in professional baseball. In 1954, the Milwaukee Braves had just moved from Boston. They sent a black player named Nat Peoples to their farm club in Atlanta. He opened on the road in Mobile for 4 games before the Braves were forced to reassign him. A year later, the Pirates, who had only just added their first black player to the big league club, tried to assign a player to the New Orleans Pelicans. The Pelicans refused to take him. Black fans in New Orleans boycotted and dropped the black attendance on the year from 40,000 to 3,000. A couple years later, the boycott spread to the entire league. The Southern Association shut itself down in 1961, still never integrating. Teams either moved elsewhere or disbanded altogether. Those racist ass nozzle team owners would rather blow up what they had built than have it tainted by a black baseball player. So no surprise that 3 years later, when the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed, it started the wholesale exodus of those same Deep South states from the Democrats to the Republicans. A word about the boycotts and the new fans that the integrated teams picked up as they added these new players. Money talks. Even Jackie Robinson himself wrote in his autobiography that, quote, money is America's God, and business people can dig black power if it coincides with green power, end quote. And yes, I did just get to use the phrase dig black power in a historical context. You groovy cats feel me? Like any other industry, sports team owners were a bunch of greedy, penny-pinching bastards. For a century, the owners had been operating with some version of a reserve clause. That meant that the team signed a player and then kept all the rights to that player even after that player's employment contract ended. If the team wanted to, they could keep a player literally forever. There were hundreds of cases where star players got their salaries cut after a great year because the owners could do whatever they damn well pleased. You couldn't leave. One of those players was Curt Flood, who was a star outfielder for the Cardinals. He had been a big part of the 1967 World Series winners, and then in 1968, the Cardinals went back to the World Series but lost to the Tigers. Flood made an error in the final game. During the offseason, the Cardinals gave him trouble when he tried to get a $15,000 a year raise. A year later, at the end of the 1969 season, Flood got traded to the Phillies, and they notified him about the trade via some stooge flunky who probably spent most of his time eating paste and sticking Marks-a-Lots up his nose. Curt Flood refused to go. He said the Phillies were a racist organization. Well, I've already gone over several cases that prove that is true. And it hadn't changed. Not long before, Phillies fans had dumped garbage on the front lawn of their biggest star, Dick Allen, who happened to be black. Curt Flood filed a lawsuit against the reserve clause and very pointedly compared the system to slavery. Flood called himself a, quote, well-paid slave. He wrote a letter to the baseball commissioner, Bowie Kuhn, and said, quote, after 12 years in the major leagues, I do not feel that I am a piece of property to be bought and sold irrespective of my wishes. I believe that any system which produces that result violates my basic rights as a citizen and is inconsistent with the laws of the United States and of the several states. End quote. Okay, a lawyer probably helped Curt with that last part. Marvin Miller was the players' union representative, and he wholeheartedly backed Curt Flood. The case went to federal court, and a whole passel of suck-up players testified against Flood. One of them was that fucking tool Joe Garagiola. Only two players had the cojones to testify in support of Curt Flood's case. Jackie Robinson and Hank Greenberg. Character rises to the top every time. Flood lost, and the case got appealed to the Supreme Court. One justice had to recuse himself because he owned a large amount of Anheuser-Busch stock, and that's who owned the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, remember back, 12 seconds ago when I mentioned character? Well, that is something that current justices Thomas and Alito wouldn't recognize if it was a snapping turtle hanging off their neck fat. The other justices sided with the team owners by a count of 5-3, but they also warned that baseball's unique antitrust exemption was hanging by a spiderweb strand. They lost the case, but free agency in baseball started just a couple years later, allowing guys to sign contracts like normal humans. Basketball star Oscar Robertson took on the NBA almost immediately afterwards. Basketball got free agency in 1976. The NFL had a couple of weird rules that tempered the reserve clause, but made it either so it cost the players a 10% salary cut or heavily penalized a team for signing free agents. Consequently, fewer than 5 players took advantage of it over 45 years. The whole point of being free to negotiate is to make more money, not less, right? Unless you're some self-flagellating Dan Brown monk. Pro football finally got real free agency in 1993. To close, there were some sad final scenes of the Jackie Robinson story, where he got stuck in politics related to civil rights. Even after he retired, Jackie Robinson was the most influential black man in America. No one else was even close for a while, but Jackie was also a Republican when most all the people pushing for civil rights had been Democrats for decades. Richard Nixon and Jackie had become friends back in 1952 and had bonded over sports and shooting the shit about Southern California where both of them lived. On the other hand, Jackie became very disillusioned over Eisenhower, Nixon's boss, not doing enough to improve the situation of American blacks. When the 1960 election came around and Nixon was running for president for the first time, Jackie backed Hubert Humphrey in the primaries against Kennedy. In fact, he got into it with Kennedy and confronted JFK in person over not backing civil rights legislation and having such close relationships with segregationists. Like I have told you before, JFK's modern reputation as some kind of liberal is undeserved nostalgia, aka bull dookie if you wander past the auction barn. Ultimately, Jackie Robinson backed Nixon in the 1960 general election. His wife Rachel pushed Jackie to quit the campaign since she noticed he was like the only black guy up there. And that was before Republicans realized they could just hire minority actors to stand in the crowd and look stone-faced. After that election was over, Jackie had all of these clashes in print with various civil rights leaders, especially Malcolm X, who did not have good things to say about America's biggest black hero. In 1964, Jackie went to the Republican convention as a delegate, where they nominated Goldwater, who was a staunch segregationist. Jackie spoke out in the newspapers during the convention and said the Republicans were now, quote, completely the white man's party, end quote. The next day, some white guy delegate challenged Jackie Robinson to a fist fight on the convention floor. In 1968, Jackie endorsed Hubert Humphrey against his old pal Nixon. And 4 years after that, he said, quote, I have grown wiser and closer to the truths about America's destructiveness, end quote. And that's all you can ask. Recognize the liars, haters, and con men and learn from our mistakes. Jackie's autobiography came out in 1972, and he wrote this, quote, I can't believe that I haven't made, while so many of my black brothers and sisters are hungry, inadequately housed, insufficiently clothed, denied their dignity, live in slums, or barely exist on welfare. End quote. Whether people realize it or not, some of the biggest civil rights heroes we have in the United States were sports stars. They had a platform, and they used it. Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell, Oscar Robertson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Elgin Baylor, Jim Brown. All those guys were out there on the front lines. Some white owners and coaches also deserve a cookie for doing the right thing in the face of opposition. Al Davis of the Raiders refused to let his team be segregated in hotels. Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich are still doing it in the NBA. You had Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists on the Olympic podium in Mexico City in 1968. And that kept race issues in the forefront like nothing else could. Pissed millions of people off, just like Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, but it was a protest. It sure as shit wasn't like they lynched somebody. Before I go, there is one very important announcement. I am going to be unable to cut any new full-length episodes for a few weeks, so I've got 2 or 3 little Prick the Balloon shorts set to drop while I am away. Though if you're wearing balloon shorts, you've likely got other things on your mind. I've got it set up where these shorts will drop mechanically, relying on a gerbil and a wheel, tiny pulleys, monofilament fishing line, a ball bearing, and a dissolving pillar of salt. Okay, not really, but that would be cool as shit, right? Yeah. Hopefully, they'll remind you that I am still here, and you can expect a new full-length episode in about 6 weeks. As always, I really appreciate you being a listener, and keep spreading the word. Please make sure you have also clicked follow on whatever platform you use. That way, you won't miss the shorts, plus it helps me out. So does buying a book or two. You can find those on my website, and of course on Amazon, or you can order them from your favorite small or large bookstore, even medium-sized bookstores. Just ask them to do a search on that fancy little internal computer system, which may or may not be powered by a gerbil on a wheel. Just saying. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out my website at mikevancewriter.com. Prick the Balloon is copyrighted by Mike Vance, all rights reserved.